You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Time to check in with Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com. He writes The Ellis Insight, and he has some for us today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, thank you as always.
A lot to look back on, and Tuesday election, we pretty much knew how it was going to go for Biden and Trump, as they both already secured enough for their nomination. But it became the down-ticket items that were focused on, and one in Ohio specifically.
Well, the big news on that race, and this was won by businessman Bernie Marino, the Republican primary for the U.S. Senate, and he will then challenge Senator Sherrod Brown, a Democrat, in the general election in one of the most important races in the whole country. So this race was viewed by the pollsters, multiple pollsters, as being just really tight, a three-way race. And then in the last week, it was viewed as a two-way race, and it was going back and forth between Marino and a state senator by the name of Matt Dolan. At the end of the day, Marino wins by a huge margin. In fact, if it were a runoff state, he would have won a majority.
Well, and of course, he credits specifically Trump with this, because Trump came in kind of at the last minute here.
Republican Senator J.D. Vance had also endorsed Bernie Marino, but the governor, Mike DeWine, the Republican governor, had endorsed Senator Dolan. So, it was a huge landslide for Marino, and that was certainly unexpected.
Yeah. And I want to thank President Trump for all he did for me, for this campaign, for his unwavering support, for his love of this country.
Well, we also had some other interesting things come out, too. And in California, we had the special election to replace former Speaker Kevin McCarthy in the Bakersfield area. And we've really got another interesting situation, because it's a rerun, really, of what we saw 2 weeks ago. In the regular primary, of course, we had a top two jungle primary that evolved into a race in the general election between two Republicans, Assemblyman Vince Fong and Tulare County Sheriff Mike Bordeaux. The same thing happened in the special election. And so come May 21st, we will see the two of them square off one-on-one. The winner will take the seat immediately. But then the two of them again will square off on the November 5th regular general election. So it's kind of a bizarre situation, because Governor Newsom really had no choice as to when he scheduled that special election. I'm sure a lot of people wonder, well, why didn't they just make it concurrent with the primary, as most places do? But he couldn't do that, because under California law, there's a certain number of days has to elapse between a vacancy being created and when you can have a special election. So that's why he had to schedule it when he did.
Yeah. All right, now to the bloodbath controversy, a term that is used by both sides of the aisle all the time in news stories. When the stock market goes way down, they call it a bloodbath. When something else happens, it's a bloodbath. But Donald Trump can't use the word bloodbath without being criticized by the left media. And, of course, when you look at the story itself, and I'm going to read you the way the wire copy reads, you're going to see that the media did a shocking omission here. This is how the story reads out of Dayton, Ohio. Donald Trump says it's going to be a bloodbath for the country if he's not elected this year. The former president made those comments Saturday while he spoke at a campaign rally near Dayton, Ohio. What they failed to report is he was talking about if cars in the auto industry are made and shifted to China because they'd be EVs, it would be a bloodbath for the auto industry. That's what the story really was. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi jumps all over this and tries to make a big stink about it.
Praising Hitler, praising the Russians, honestly, I mean, condemning our soldiers for losing or dying in war. You wouldn't even allow them in your house, much less in the White House.
She ties it to the bloodbath comment, and it's just not accurate, and the left runs with it.
Exactly, and it's great to be on the left, particularly if you're in the media, Larry. You don't have to bother with any research. All you have to do is make up your own story. The facts don't get in the way of their reporting. This will blow over again, but so it's such a double standard, it's not even funny. And I think people are seeing through that. And certainly the vote totals are showing us that, at least in turnout around the country for this presidential race. And you know, hopefully this rectifies itself. But on that turnout is interesting because we've had now 26 states that have had their primary caucus or primary. And in 22 of them, Republicans have outpolled Democrats. In other words, more Republicans voted than Democrats by wide, wide margins. And this is a warning sign to the Democrats and why they're going now so hard left. Because in 10 of those 22 states that Republicans did better than Democrats on the primary turnout, Biden won. Places like Colorado and Minnesota and Michigan, and that has them scared. And that's why they're running so hard to the left, because they've got to engender more enthusiasm within that Democratic base. Yeah. It's a big warning sign for them right now.
Well, I think that somebody has gotten to Biden and told him he's not doing so well because it was going to be, you know, campaigning from his basement, and now he's out and about campaigning on various states, and he's going into swing states, and here's what he said. This lets you know that he knows what's going down.
I need you badly. I need the help. Kamala and I desperately need your help. Because, look, there's only about six or seven states that are going to determine the outcome of this election. They're toss-up states. This is one of them.
That was in Phoenix earlier in the week. He was there to engage and mobilize Latino voters and communities. So he realizes it's not an easy win for him, is it?
I think they're panicked. And I think that's why you see certain things happening. The why he gave that political left-wing, hard left-wing speech at the State of the Union, and why they have him out there. I'm not sure that's going to help them.
Yeah. And by the way, speaking of that speech that he gave at the State of the Union, the polling is out, and it did not give him a bump at all, which is interesting, isn't it?
Well, and it was designed to really engender more enthusiasm within the left-wing base, and I think it failed there, too.
He is raising a lot of money, and
You
know, $50-something million in a one-month haul. Meanwhile, you've got Trump and the lawfare, and, you know, he's supposed to come up with almost $500 million just to post a bond in one case, and nobody will write a bond like that. And, you know, it really I don't know if it helps Trump or hurts Trump, but people got to realize they're squeezing him at all sorts of angles here, and I think people realize that.
Well, and it's a major factor, and the money is a major factor, too, and it's not just at the presidential races, throughout the entire ballot, and it's those down-ballot races that we're talking about in the Senate and the House where it's going to be impacted in a greater fashion. People know who's running for president, and they know what they're going to do by and large. But in these down ballot races, the resource advantage that the Democrats have is a major factor, and it could turn some races. So it's something to be concerned about from the conservative slash Republican standpoint.
Right. And then, of course, you have a new sheriff in town for the RNC, and they're promising, they say they get it, that they need to have their ground game out. They need to get people to vote early. I don't want to say vote early and often, but, you know, don't just vote on election day.
Yes, I know the RNC is talking about that. They need to concentrate on fundraising so that they can at least come into somewhat of parity in, against the Democrats in all of these races. So, but you're right. They have to have the ground game to turn out that vote, whether it's early or whether it's on election day. That's what matters.
So what's causing the difficulty for Republicans? Is it that they've now shifted to a more blue-collar party and the elites are over on the wealthy elites are on the Democrat side and they just have more money? Or do Republicans hold tight to their money because, you know, they don't want to put something on something they don't win?
I'm not sure. I think it's a combination of Republicans being somewhat down on where they ought to be on fundraising, and I think it's mechanical inside the RNC operation in particular, and I think that's why President Trump wanted to make the change with moving out Ronna McDaniel there. I think that was the main reason, that they just weren't raising the money that they have in the past, although I don't think they were that far behind. I think the big thing is that the astounding number that the Democrats are posting. And so when you have them reaching record highs in fundraising and Republicans being a little bit under where they typically should be, the combination has created a very large gap.
Right. Well, we know what the issues are going to be. If you're a Republican, it's going to be the border and illegals coming in and then illegals committing some horrific crimes, allegedly. And if you're a Democrat, it's going to be abortion, 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 right?
Yes. and the economy for Republicans too. I mean, they have to really drive that economic issue home.
What's wrong with the economy? Didn't Bidenomics turn everything around, and we have all this infrastructure in the pipeline, right?
Well, yes, according to them, yes. Again, but the average person doesn't see that, and it's clear that when you look at poll after poll, they don't feel Biden's done a good job. Bidenomics hasn't worked. And people know that. And so I don't think you're going to hear that term even coming out of the Democrats anymore. But they're going to talk about a more robust economy. They're going to concentrate on the jobs report. But, you know, projections as we get closer to the election, at least even from the Congressional Budget Office, show that we might be seeing a downturn on some of the economic numbers. And that may not bode well for Biden if that portends to be the case.
Yeah, gasoline prices are on their way back up, and Biden's already mostly depleted the petroleum reserve, so he can't play that game again. Interesting.
Yes, and that's what brought it down. They're talking about, the America is pumping more oil than they did even under Trump. Well, that's because Biden knew he was in trouble and knew it was hurting him, and he did exactly what you said with the strategic oil reserves, releasing those. But it's not something you can just turn a switch and then automatically see all of the oil production increase. So we have likely an increase in gas prices, things that people see. That's the important thing. When they go to the grocery store, buying a new house, filling up their cars with gasoline, and that's why they don't buy. The Bidenomics has been successful.
Oh, yeah, and buying a new house. Thank you very much for that $400 a month that Biden wants to offer up some more candy here for first-time buyers, the younger voters, of course. And all it's going to do is cause more house inflation. If you know that there's $400 a month more coming in, what do? You charge more when you sell your house. Think.
Sure.
That's how it works. Democrats don't care. It's about the free money to buy votes. Just like, the twice now paying off your college debt, even though it's most likely unconstitutional. It's all about what you say. If you're a Democrat, you hand out the candy. Jim Ellis, EllisInsight.com. The Ellis Insight. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Rabbi Ron LaPaz is a Los Angeles rabbi and advocate for interreligious understanding across the globe, and he joins us. Thank you so much for being with us again.
My pleasure, Larry. Great to be with you.
The highest-ranking Jewish elected official, Schumer, from the Senate, gets up and announces the other day his criticism of the Israeli government.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has lost his way by allowing his political survival to take the precedence over the best interests of Israel.
And then he goes on to say the Israeli prime minister hasn't done enough to protect civilians.
He has put himself in coalition with far-right extremists like Minister Smotrich and Ben-Gavir. And as a result, he has been too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza, which is pushing support for Israel worldwide to historic lows.
And he says change is needed.
As a lifelong supporter of Israel, it has become clear to me the Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th. The world has changed radically since then.
All right. Let's get your reaction.
Well, I think if this story was occurring in a different year in American politics, we'd be looking at it differently. We wouldn't even be hearing the same word, same speech. You know, regime change is something that we've always talked about. It's a term that all of us kind of understand. It usually doesn't work when an outside power wants a regime to change in another country. In this case, this isn't some rogue regime. You know, this is a robust democracy, a reliably robust democracy. This is a really powerful democracy in terms of the citizens' voices being heard and mattering, coming to matter in the society. So to say that about Israel, that this is the American point of view, that we want to essentially see regime change, I think is a little out of place. Let's call it rude in simple terms. I think if the Israeli people want a new prime minister, there will be a new prime minister. I'm pretty certain, based on my read, not only of Israeli history, but of the current state of affairs there, that there will be a change in government soon after the war. But Israel's more used to this scenario than America is. sadly, you know, not for the U.S., but for Israel, they're used to war, and they're used to the aftermath of war when there is not only an analysis of what occurred, but then often an election, maybe always, consistently, an election, a chance for the public to say, we want to see something the same or different. My guess is this is the end of the Netanyahu reign, because he's been in power for a long, long time. He isn't a new figure, as all of us know, but also because I think, you know, people have to be held accountable for what happened on October 7th, and it has to rise to the top, which means that my assumption is that he'll go afterwards. But Israelis, generally, the ones I speak to, and historically the ones I remember, would say that during a war, you don't discuss the election or even do the analysis. You wait for the war to settle. You wait for the goals to be achieved, and then you do that. So I mentioned at the outset that timing matters. And the reason I'm saying this is because, you know, as somebody said, right now the U.S. is concerned with a two-state solution, and that's Nevada and Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is a case in point. I think Schumer is in lockstep with the administration. There's no way that this speech wasn't passed by or even crafted alongside or with the administration. I think they are very careful in their wording right now. They are being overtly critical of Israel in order to get the votes in the U.S. and to bolster their support here. And at the same time, they're also, through Jake Sullivan, through the president, also saying what I'll say are the honest and right things, which is Israel has to complete its task and get rid of Hamas. That means going into Rafah in as calculated and careful a way as possible, but it has to be done.
All right, here's some more sound. This is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was on CNN State of the Union, says the majority of Israelis support the country's approach to the war against Hamas.
If Senator Schumer opposes these policies, he's not opposing me. He's opposing the people of Israel.
He goes on to say he referenced a tragedy in U.S. history to criticize Schumer's call for elections.
After 9/11, you're in the midst of fighting the war against Al-Qaeda, and an Israeli would say, you know, what we need now is either new elections in the U.S., or if your system doesn't allow, then President Bush should resign.
You have that story, and then a couple of weeks back, you had the State of the Union address where President Biden announced that he wants somehow to have built some sort of a pier or place to offload items to get to people in Gaza. Critics say, well, wait a second, you can't really build anything unless you're going to defend it or the people building it are going to get killed. And that's going to draw us in more. What do you have here? And we don't get to find out exactly what the plan is. Some people say you put any items and get them to Gaza, they'll just be taken by Hamas and not get to the people. Hamas has got a history of taking this stuff. And there was, of course, that story allegedly about Israeli soldiers shooting up people at a place where they were getting food. Some people question the story as far as its accuracy and really understanding what had happened. Some in the left-leaning media jumped all over it and said, aha, Israelis are shooting innocent civilians. I mean, the fog of war gets a little dicey, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, of course it does. Not only what actually occurred, but how it gets reported and how the reporting supports the agenda of the media, especially here in the U.S. I think the media, remember that Israel is left and right and center, just in the way that we are. I think most Israelis, by the way, are, like most of us, essentially centrist, left or right, but centrist, not extremist. There are extremists on both sides, but the media, of course, tends to draw out whatever will get the most clicks right now. You know, there's no question that humanitarian aid has to come in and does get into Gaza and needs to be flooding Gaza, in the words of the administration right now. And it is. I understand that it's coming in from the air and from the sea and from the ground, most effectively from the air. They're just dropping, like we did in World War II, after package of aid. That's essential. That has to happen. But building another infrastructure that can then be destroyed by terrorists isn't a great idea. I'm assuming, just based on photographs that I've seen of the mini pier that's already been constructed, that something effective has been started. I don't know how permanent it will be how ultimately effective it will be.
Yeah. Prior to the beginning of October, I thought this was a U.S. that supported Israel pretty close to. Now, after October, I'm on the freeway, the 101 freeway. In the overpass, there are protesters and people are honking horns, and it's all about free Palestine and all sorts of stuff on the other side. Which is it? Do you know?
I think it's both. I think the U.S. administration after administration since Israel's birth has been supportive of Israel. I think right now we're getting an America that is deeply polarized and divided. We've got oppressor-victim philosophy that's coursing through the press and the universities and coming to the dining tables of homes. And the assumption is that we have to oppress, we have to stand up and fight against the strong and the mighty and assume that that means the oppressive. But we know in reality that's not the case. So people aren't willing to take a deeper look because it's too challenging and too uncomfortable. And then we have this cognitive dissonance. What is it that I believe versus what I'm being told? What's true? I'm going to stick with what feels true. And the overpass protests and the assumption that free Palestine is something that anybody other than the Palestinian leadership should be doing. I think there's no question all of us want to see every human being on earth living with dignity and freedom and basic human rights at a minimum, including Palestinians.
All right. But that's not what Hamas would offer. The same people who are up protesting for free Palestine don't understand or don't think about the fact that there are many marginalized groups in this country who live with freedoms that they would not accept. Gays, lesbians, the whole LGBT community, they don't accept that, do they?
Yeah, of course. But again, that's coming back to especially the youngest generations here in this country who are, you know, talk about cognitive dissonance. You know, the whole idea of queers for Palestine makes my head spin. You have any idea what it is to be anything other than heterosexual in a repressive Islamic society like Gaza or even around the Middle East? It's ridiculous.
Yet that is the way people parse their opinions these days. They can be pro this even though there's that. And I don't know if they aren't aware of it or they don't care.
Yeah, I don't think they care. Honestly, I think there is a certain awareness. Look, there's a lot of ignorance. And when you see man on the street, woman on the street interviews, you know, obviously they pinpoint a lot of, you know, shocking ignorance. People don't know where things are on the planet. They don't really understand anything about Gaza. They don't know any history, not an ounce of the history of Israel before it became the current modern state in 1948, even a minute before what occurred, or what's happened since. So they go with a singular narrative. And whenever any of us are targeted with a singular narrative, a lot is lost. We're always going to be harmed in that. So they grab a narrative that fits their own agenda, which is, if I am an oppressed human being in this country, oppressed by either reality, but probably that's not the case in many cases, instead my own perception of oppression, because I am a marginalized group, I'm a minority group, then I'm going to align myself with any and all marginal or minority groups around the world, regardless of reality.
I got to leave it with this one. This is House Speaker Mike Johnson lashed out at Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, over his comments.
We have to stand with and support them right now. But what you're seeing from the White House and clearly from the Senate Democrats is really exactly the opposite. They seem to be standing with and supporting Iran and its proxies instead.
Hold on. The ride is going to be wild over the next several months, isn't it?
It sure is. I think the war that we're not talking about is the war against Trump. And all of this, from the administrative point of view and the media's point of view, is we have to fight the great battle, in the Iranian terms, you'd say, against the great Satan, which is the one within the U.S. And in their case, that's Donald Trump and the fear that he'll take away their power and get into power as president.
With that, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer. You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Steve Frank is publisher of California Political News and Views, and he joins us to talk, well, politics from California perspective. And Steve, thank you for joining us once again.
Always glad to be with you, Larry.
You've got a story for us having to do with the new employees in the state. Job growth numbers being revised. Not so good after all. Tell us this story.
Well, the governor has, like a Democrat, tries to embellish the truth. So for 22-23 year, the governor claimed that California gained over 300,000 new employees. But after the revisions were made, that 300,000 turned out to be 50,000. But when you look at the 50,000, you find that some of those are people holding two jobs. Most of them are low-wage jobs, and a large number are illegal aliens who shouldn't be holding jobs in the first place. All of that leads to the fact that California has an unemployment rate of 5.1%. The federal unemployment rate nationally is 3.6%. We are one of the highest unemployment states in the nation, but the governor running for president is crowing about the 300,000 jobs he created in 1 year, which didn't exist.
Well, I missed that in his, he didn't give it, did he? He delayed his State of the State address, didn't he? Have you noticed that? On a late Friday evening, he puts out an advisory. It was supposed to be last Monday, but I guess with numbers like that and with the hole in the budget that he needs to fill, things wouldn't be so good to get up there and crow right now, right?
But he gave a reason that he wanted to wait to give the state of the state address until after the votes were counted for Proposition 1. Well, that's nice to know, but what does that have to do with the state of the state? There's something else behind this, because waiting for an election result on a ballot proposition is nothing to crow about when you want to stop the state of the state.
Yep.
There's something else going on.
Well, he's got a slight few extra votes on his side on this Proposition 1. They've spent $6 million to push it, but it ain't popular because it's so close. And in fact, did you see the story that both sides are reactivating their efforts to fight for this thing or against it, that they thought it was a done deal, but it may not be, so it continues on. Here's a story for you. Let's talk fires. Unhoused fires in our community. This week we learned that a restaurant in the San Fernando Valley was set on fire, and security video shows that homeless people, let me correct that, unhoused people started it. One of the owners says that if a Good Samaritan hadn't rushed over to put the fire out, things could have been a lot worse.
It was right next to our offices, our grease trap, and also where we store our propane tanks. We're lucky that it really wasn't a lot more serious.
One of the owners says homeless people, or the unhoused, have increasingly been targeting her business with break-ins, vandalism, and now fire.
I'm very upset and frightened that this is even happening.
And she's not alone. A lot of businesses are reporting recent break-ins and people setting up warming fires in their parking lot. What's going on in this wonderful golden state of California?
Well, in Los Angeles, last year we had a whole series of fires underneath the freeway, and in fact closed down the freeway because of the fires. The city wanted to clean out the encampment, and it took 5 months for government agencies to create the permits and the courts to allow the cleaning out of the encampments to stop the fires to save the freeway from being closed again. 5 months of bureaucratic garbage in order to do what should have been done just immediately and without asking the court's permission to protect the freeway and protect private property.
Mm. Talk about timely, you know, in 5 months to get those permits. All right, let's talk wages, and let's talk the $20 an hour fast food worker industry You know, you and I know that, you know, that was pushed through by the unions, the concept of getting the 20-hour base, and some of the businesses already have, you know, cut back and trimmed people to try to make up for it. You know, get ready for that $15 burger, fry, and a Coke. It's going to go up. A world that has gone crazy where politicians think that just by raising the floor, that solves everything in the fast food industry, as opposed to creating another round of inflation. How about that? And then we all can't afford that, and it's a vicious cycle. Your thoughts?
Well, a week ago, I was down in Rancho Santa Margarita down in Orange County, and we stopped, my wife and I stopped off at a McDonald's, and they didn't have anybody at the counter. You couldn't place an order at the counter. They only had kiosks. And the reason you have kiosks rather than people, kiosks don't get $20 an hour, don't get coffee breaks, don't take vacations, don't take sick days, don't have unions. And so on April 1st, when the new law becomes official in the state of California, you're going to see tens of thousands of people laid off from their fast food jobs. And over the months, you're going to see more kiosks, fewer people, less service, and much higher cost for the so-called fast food. Fast food may be fast, but it's not cheap anymore. And it's not for a family of four. If you leave a McDonald's, it's $40. And, of course, when this comes into play on April 1st, McDonald's has said this adds $250,000 a year to the cost of each franchise shop. So you have to add that $250,000 to the hamburgers and fries that McDonald's, Wendy's, and all the other places serve.
Yeah. Those who fight for these kinds of things think they're doing God's work. They think they're helping workers. But they're taking a generation that won't have entry-level jobs anywhere away so that they're permanently unemployed, or they're pushing them elsewhere. Now, I happen to think that working at one of those restaurants is fine, but it was never designed to be the be-all, end-all job that it has become. And you have to look at some of the factors behind this. Experts say we've literally driven manufacturing out of California. So we still have people here that want to do something. So you've got, you know, people 50s, 60s working in fast food places trying to make a buck, and I don't fault them, but we drove manufacturing out of our state, didn't we?
So exactly. And now it's going to get worse. You're talking about the $20 fast food minimum wage. The left is beginning to do a series of stories that the $16 California minimum wage is not enough to live on, and that we need to raise that. So in the next year or so, we're going to start seeing the Democrats move the $16 minimum wage up to the $20 level that the fast food employees are going to get, those that have a job. And we're going to see even more inflation in the state of California. Yeah. Remember, we also were the highest states for inflation, yeah, because of all these laws.
You remember Barbara Lee and the debates for the Senate, the member of Congress, who was, of course, she didn't get anywhere with it, but she was pushing for a $50 an hour minimum wage. How does that sound?
$100,000 a year to flip burgers? Why not?
Well, why not is because they don't think through what that would mean on the economy. It would be devastating to do that, to throw a $50 minimum wage. The market isn't there to support it. It's the government telling business what they have to do. It literally kills remaining businesses in this state. But that's how devoted they are to these policies. And you want to call them socialist, you want to call them draconian, whatever you want to call them. I think people realize they don't fly, right?
No, they don't. But to add on it, Bernie Sanders wanting a 32-hour work week with people getting paid as if they worked for 40 hours.
Right, with punishments for that. Speaking of punishments, did you see the story that they're floating the idea of an exit tax in California as a potential way to rebound on the money that is shortfalled in our state? Back being discussed is the wealth tax but an exit tax that would then tax people who left the state for several years. Whether or not it's constitutional really isn't an issue. It's just you get something fast, you put it on the books, you say your budget is balanced, and then you let it fight out in the courts to where you find out that it isn't legal, but you do it anyway. Just like Biden with the handouts to those with, you know, loans. It's not constitutional, but you do it, and then you do it again, right?
No, exactly. And the proposal is, for 10 years after you leave the state of California, you still get taxed on your income as if you're a resident of California. And the theory they have is, since you lived here for a period of time, you benefited from California, and you took those benefits with you to another state, and so we're going to tax you on that for 10 years.
Oh. Your thought about it. I mean, look, I get it. I don't hit the level at which the, you know, multi-millionaires and billionaires per year income would be taxed. But it kind of scares me when they do a wealth tax, when the very wealth you own is to be taken from you in portions. It doesn't seem right. Even if you are wealthy, that, you know, they want to have some exceptions for some real estate, a few carve-outs to the realty industry. But very sad. Last story I'll leave you with real quick. ATRA is out saying that, well, this doesn't surprise anyone, huge amounts of money were donated to Governor Newsom and other Democrats over the past 6 years from trial lawyers. A report from the American Tort Reform Association shows Newsom getting over $1 million from 20 law firms. The firms also spent almost $1 million in the effort to defeat a Newsom recall back in 2022.
California is a pay-for-play state. And as long as the attorneys and other special interests give money to Gavin Newsom and the Democrat Party and the governor will play ball with them and give them what they want or think they need, or protect them from common sense legislation that would protect the citizens of California. This isn't a democracy in California. This is a Richard Daley Chicago state.
It's a cash register is what it is. Steve Frank, thank you so much. Publisher of California Political News and Views. We'll talk to you next time.
Have a great day.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
My guest is Steve Greenhut. He is the co-author of a new Pacific Research Institute, a booklet on giving the housing supply a boost. And he is my guest. Steve, good to talk with you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For those who say, hey, that name is familiar, you read him in the Orange County Register and other papers with the group that you're associated with as well, right?
That's right. So I'm on the editorial board of the Southern California News Group and work for the R Street Institute, a think tank.
All right. Let's talk giving housing a boost. We always hear that there's just a woefully short supply of new housing. Having done interviews on the subject, I get people tell me things like, well, you've got people who don't want to see that much more housing. They make it very difficult, the permitting process, the fees, the cost, the labor, the supplies, you name it. There's lots of reasons. And then they sometimes tell me things like, and of course there's CEQA. And then my eyes glaze over. CEQA? What's that? And then they get into lawsuits that are used to stop housing and payoffs to union for construction sites, all sorts of stuff going on. But what do you identify, having done this for so many years on the Register and having written, as some of the problems why we don't build much new housing?
Yeah, it's really been a concerted effort by the state for, you know, the last couple, three decades, really. You know, we used to be a very pro-growth state, even in the days of, you know, Pat Brown. It was California. We're going to build the biggest and the best and the freeways and the free university system, and we're going to bring people here, and they're going to enjoy the California dream. And really, since the 70s and 80s, it's been all sorts of efforts driven, I think, by the new ethic, the more environmentalist approach. So, CEQA, as you pointed out, is one of those biggies that was actually signed by Governor Ronald Reagan, but it it basically allows anybody to file a lawsuit to slow, stop, add costs to any project you may or may not like. As you alluded to, unions will use it to shake down developers to get high-priced union contracts. It's a mess. It slows slows things down and adds costs to every project. We've a variety of court decisions have allowed cities to just hammer developers for fees. So fees are supposed to be tied to the impacts of the project on the infrastructure, but the courts have allowed cities to just use it as a shakedown so that they can just get everything they want out of developers in exchange for allowing the development. We've passed all these urban growth boundaries.
Oh, yes. Yes, we see these stories about, you know, Pasadena where they, you know, have, you know, typically two-story houses, one-story house, and then all of a sudden the state wants to come in and say you have to put in a 30-story building right next to that. And it's like, hey, but we're the local. Don't we have local control? So there's this big fight. Huntington Beach, another one. You have to build so many of this kind of housing. And they're saying, but wait, there's an ocean. We're pretty much done building. What are we going to do? And you get these fights. So take us into some of that, because that urban planning that's being hoisted on top of cities isn't getting a great response locally.
Well, right. You've got the, yes, this push for like this new urbanism where we're going to be everything within the urban growth boundary and push everyone into moving into, you know, high density housing, which some people like, and that's fine. And I'm all in favor of the recent laws that allow developers to build higher density. So that's one thing. That's kind of an ideological push that has driven up the cost of housing. And it does cost a lot more to build infill units than in greenfields. But the other thing has been similar to what like Huntington Beach has been doing, the old NIMBY stuff. We don't want any more here. And Huntington Beach has filed a lawsuit against the state. They're trying to stop the new laws that allow more building. So I actually disagree with Huntington Beach on this. But I've seen it when I lived in Southern California, see it up here where local communities vote on projects. And usually if you already have your house, the chances are you're not going to want more houses near you. I mean, I've seen ones where, I just saw one where people who just moved into a brand new neighborhood then lobbied against the construction of new housing on the lovely open land near them. Well, yeah. So it's just this whole business. And in some places, like I when I worked at the Union Tribune, I did a story about the in San Diego County where about 40% of the price of a new house is attributed to government regulations.
Ow. Real quick, I want to ask you about some other ones. We've seen these stories for a while. I don't see too much right now, but about a year and a half, 2 years ago, it was all about these dwellings that you could add on top, like a granny house. And then they came along and said, okay, not only can you put a granny house in an extra one, but that one can be sold off separate from yours. Aha! And local people don't have any control over it. I mean, you give them an inch, they take a yard.
No, I think that's, I love those laws. They're property rights enhancing laws, right? They're, you know, the, I don't have a right to say what my neighbor should do on their property, right? I mean, in a free market, kind of world, we don't get to vote as a neighborhood on what you get to do on your property or in your house or, you know, so this whole concept, that, oh my God, someone's going to be able to use their property as they see fit. We don't get to oppose that anymore. I mean, I actually think that's a good one. It's just not going to make a huge dent because how many people, you know, have enough yardage
to put another,
the wherewithal to build. So it actually, you know, there have been studies. It hasn't resulted in many new units, but I see nothing wrong with it. I mean, I think granny flats are a great idea and being able to, build a duplex that helps around the margins, but it's not making that big of a deal.
So the people who complain about it find the strongest reasons they can, and they kind of make sense. Well, we haven't built enough. They're not, you know, driveway spaces, and the streets are already full, and there's no room to put the trash cans out on the day that the trash goes. And, you know, you're just coming in on top, making new regulations, you know, not letting the process take its place, that there were rules to take it to a planning commission and a community could vote it down. But it sounds like that doesn't bother you too much.
Well, that I don't like that process. That process is why we haven't been building houses for all these years, right? Because we've created this process which is just a kind of a big government process where people get to vote on what other people build. People get to file lawsuits against what other people propose to build based on, you know, CEQA, where neighborhoods, people come out and oppose what somebody else is going to do on an adjacent property. And then the process is tilted really heavily towards, you know, that kind of NIMBYism.
Right.
Now, the YIMBYs have problems of their own, and I battle with them all the time. They drive me nuts. But it's for a different set of reasons.
So are you for it totally free to do what you want? I mean, there's some neighborhoods where you can't even change the color of your house without going to your neighbors and getting it signed off. I mean, you know, there are communities that are designed that way to protect the flavor and feeling of the neighborhood, right?
Well, you know, in Houston, right, yeah, those things drive me nuts. I accidentally moved into one once, and we lasted, I think, a year and a month. It just took that long for us to get the heck out of there and sell our house. So that's not for me. But, you know, in Houston, where they still don't have zoning, I think Houston's a great city other than the climate, but what people who want to live in a more protected environment and want to have more control, they move into gated communities with protective covenants. So where privately, you know, we all agree as terms and conditions of moving into this neighborhood that nobody could paint anything other than the three pre-selected colors of beige. It's beige, even a color or whatever, shades of beige. I wouldn't move into one of those places, but that's the way the free market deals with that. In regular cities, I'm in favor of, allowing more property rights and more freedom, which means allowing, you know, in these new laws where you're building where you're allowed to build a duplex under SB9, you still have to follow a whole bunch of regulations, setbacks.
Right.
It's not anything goes.
Hey, real quick, because I only have a couple of minutes. What does the booklet say? Give us kind of the talking points so that our listeners will come away with
it. We went through... We go through all the many reasons that housing supply has been diminished and kind of chapter and verse of many of these things we talked about. Also talk about the separate issue, and this is with Wayne Weingarten, my co-author, and he's kind of a homelessness expert, and we write about, the tangential homeless problem and all the many ways the state has mishandled that problem. And, homelessness is related to housing, but it's not obviously entirely a housing problem. So, and we kind of push for some variety of solutions, and it's complimentary. You can go onto the pacificresearch.org website and download a copy for free.
And, let's briefly talk on the homeless issue because, you know, I don't really know for sure, but a person on the street can't afford $3,500 a month, but they probably can't afford $1,000 a month either, right?
Well, yeah. The problem is, it housing, the homelessness issue is closely tied to social problems, mental health issues and drug addiction and other. However, in places where housing prices are so ridiculously high, it obviously becomes an enormous burden for those people at the very margins of society. So, you know, in a low-cost part of the world, it's part of the country, a homeless person might be able to flop in a room or find something they can afford. But in the high prices here, if you have some of those issues, you're not going to be able to find anything.
Right.
You end up in the street.
And briefly, in a plan like President Biden comes along saying, okay, I'll give you $400 a month toward your mortgage, what does that do? To me, it only drives up the price of houses because then people are selling houses realize the government's subsidizing them.
Yep, it's just inflation. I mean, if all of a sudden somebody's renters gets $400 a month for free money, I bet their rent's going to go up. But the state has been mishandling homelessness, as we all see. They take this housing first approach, which wants to just build a permanent house for every homeless person, and there's not enough money in the world to do that at the $800 to $1 million a unit.
My guest has been Steve Greenhut, co-author of a new Pacific Research Institute booklet taking a look at giving housing supply a boost. Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, well, thank you. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer.